Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My next guest is Ash Arora, the youngest partner at Local Globe, ranked number one early stage fund in EMEA and number three globally, with companies like Wise, Figma, Twitter, Canva, Robinhood, and LP in A16Z and Sequoia. Previously, Ash was the investment lead for 100 million Polygon Ventures Fund 1, with LPs such as Sequoia, Lightspeed, SoftBank, Tiger, and the list goes on. Everyone, give it up for Ash. Ash, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is amazing. I love what you're doing with the EU podcast.
Awesome. So I have my first fund after a year and a half of doing it. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Ash. So let's just dive straight into it. Imagine that, you know, your life is a, this is going to be a bit cheesy question, but let's go with it. Your life is a Bollywood movie.
Oh, I wish.
Yeah. What's the opening scene? Who plays you? And yeah, what's happening?
Oh wow!
I know a lot of Bollywood actors. I've been a big fan of certain movies. I've watched Three Idiots. I've watched Stars on Earth. I've watched. Right. I'm really a big fan of Amir Khan, but also I like Ranbir Kapoor a lot as well. I watched this. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it well now. It's Yevgivani.
Ye Jawani Hai Diwani. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was a good pronunciation. Nice. Yeah. I love the. You literally just named some of my all-time favorites.
Yes. Nice. I know that it's actually when I was trying to get you here in Barcelona before, I mentioned the other movie, but I now don't remember. It was about like. Yes. Yes.
I remember that. I tweeted that. So, I was very impressed that you knew about that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just, you know. I know my business. I know my Indian Hollywood movie business. All right, let's go. So your turn. What would be the opening scene and who would actually play you?
That's a very, very difficult question. See, now, if there are so many different directors in Bollywood, if I was to go for like the mainstream directors, they would want to kind of do like a rags to riches kind of theme. So it would probably be where I was born and raised, like just a snapshot of my house, and then suddenly shifting to like me maybe sitting in one of my board meetings as like the only female and the only non, you know, sort of white person in the room. And it would kind of just show like this bridge, like this drama. But yeah, honestly, if I had my way, it would be a musical because Bollywood movies have so many different musicals. And I'm like a sucker for dancing. I love to dance.
Yes.
So if the first scene can be like a musical scene about my life, that would be amazing. And that has to happen in Barcelona right after a skydive, the way it was in ZNMD.
Amazing, Ash, amazing. So there will be a Bollywood dance. Like, I love this. I never actually, because I know people who just fast forward through those and like go to, you know, the main thing, but I never do that. I love those. Ash, so I know that, you know, your story reads like high stakes thriller, actually, you know, like from refugee colony in Delhi to city, to the prime minister's office, to leading investments in over six. How many countries did you lead investment in?
Yeah, six unicorns.
Yes, sorry, countries. Yeah. Unicorns. How many companies?
Yeah.
If we zoom in on a single holy shit moment that changed everything for you, what would it be?
Wow, that's a great question. So I think there have been lots of holy shit moments already. Right. But the first one, which is also the biggest one, was when I started. I was a trader at Citi, and I started trading on the side, which was in asset classes that Citi was not trading in. And I saw my portfolio about 6x in 3 months. Which was unprecedented, because, you know, you think that value. I always kind of had like this lack of exponential, like a very linear understanding of growth. right? Which is you have a salary, you get money, you have savings, and that's consistent and uniform over a period of time. Even in like the stock portfolio and returns, you always have like 10, 20% increments year on year. But this was the first time when it went multifold. And it crossed like, you know, the corpus that I had invested in my opinion, was also like a lot of, you know, money for me. So that corpus basically became so massive that I've suddenly like, oh, I've made money at 20. What am I supposed to do with the rest of my life, right? Because that amount of money, even though it was not a lot, it was just like 100, 150K. It was massive for me. It was like this amount of capital I had never seen in my life before. So it's funny, actually, the house that I grew up in is worth less than 150K. Right. So it's like you just let that sink in. Like imagine you made in just a few months more money than the house that was worth when you were growing up. So, yeah, it was, I think that was like a holy shit moment. And that's how I understood that value creation is an exponential journey. And you have to truly solve a problem to actually hit that exponential journey. So that's basically what kind of got me attracted to tech innovation in the first place, because I was a trader, right? Like, that was never the path that I had charted out for myself. So I immediately switched over to tech and I knew that this is where I want to spend my life.
Awesome. Love it, Ash. Youngest associate at Citi, youngest partner at Local Globe. Do you just enjoy breaking into rooms where you kind of, you know, shouldn't be?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I actually have this thing where I've always said I'm the youngest person in the room at all times. Smartest, dumbest, God knows, but definitely the youngest. It's interesting because growing up, I was never this person, right? Like I was smart and I kind of took some advanced classes, but it was never like I am younger like by a decade, which has been the case since I started working at Citi. Like the second youngest person on the floor when I joined was like 9 years elder to me. So I think there are pros and cons to it, but personally, that was never a motivation. I was always going for things that I felt were out of my league, right? Like it's like dating. You go for people that are out of your league. My boyfriend will love to hear this. But yeah, it's just one of those things where I thought that I'm aspiring towards something and I'm ambitious and I see something, an opportunity, and I want to run after it. It's just my luck that even though I'm young, I get hired by the right places.
Nice. Good to get lucky like that. I like it. And is it really luck? You know, luck is always, they say, you know, when the preparation meets the opportunity. You worked on, I know that you worked on a startup policy for like 1.5 billion people back in India. You know, that's a like kind of different level of scale. What's one lesson about power and money that stuck with you? And how did that, you know, kind of shape how you see power and money in markets today?
Yeah, I think my scale of markets had a paradigm shift because of that. So to give you some context, I live in London. The population of the UK is roughly 60, 65 million right now. That is equal to the population of the top three cities of India, which is Delhi, NCR, Bombay, and Bangalore. Combined are roughly about 60 million as well, right? So when we were working with the premises office, there was a discussion around a pilot that we have to do in the top three cities of India, and that was 60 million people. A pilot is equal to the population of a country, right? That is the scale at which you operate. And then you feel that nothing is ever too big for you to fail. Nothing is ever too small for you to do. So a pilot, which is considered very small, is something that you can do with the population of an entire country and still just take that risk, take that leap of faith. If things don't work out, it's fine. Let's fix it so that we can scale it up to 1.5 billion quickly, as opposed to doing a pilot, which we obviously can. I can do like a pilot within just South Delhi, which would be like, I don't know, 2-3 million people. I can do that and then scale up to Delhi and then to the top three cities and then to the country. But the longer you be that risk averse and the more you try to perfect something, the more time you end up wasting. So to me, I think one of my biggest learnings has been that no product is ever perfect. Just ship it to market and ship it to market directly to everyone. Just learn as you go. Never think that, oh, if you ship it to like the top 10 customers you're going for, they will not like it, they will not use it, they will not pay for it. no product to this day, I feel, has been perfect at launch. So you might as well just launch, gain that first mover advantage, be the first company that can scale at that level, right? This is a question I'm asked very often. Mm-hmm. Like, you worked at a 1.5 billion people scale. Like, very few people in the history of the world have been able to get that kind of opportunity, right? So it's, for me, my scale is just very different now. Like, just go to market, hit the ground running, and, you know, iterate as you go and learn as you scale. Don't think that anything is too big or too small.
This is amazing. I love it. And also that you bet on contrarians, right? You know, tell me about a time you trusted your gut when everyone else thought you were nuts.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a very good question. So back in 2017, I was asked to do a research project on Bitcoin because I was, as you know, the youngest on the floor at Citi.
Yeah.
And they looked at me and they're like, yeah, you're in your early 20s. Like, you would know all this Bitcoin, crypto
crap. Exactly.
Right?
You're the youngest. You should know.
Exactly. You should know. Like, you would know everything. And I'm like, I don't know anything. So I spent like 3 months researching for the team, and they threw it out the window. They're like, this is too unregulated. It's too speculative. We are not going to touch it with a long foot pole. And during those 3 months while I'm researching, you know, I'm calling up my friends and family. I'm like, did you read about distributed ledgers? Do you know blockchain can do this? And dinner table conversations and social events. And I'm bowling. And I remember like explaining how, you know, node runners work while bowling, like while dropping the pins. I'm explaining how one node falls down, this happens, that node stands up. Like, I'm just explaining like the technical architecture of blockchain. And yeah, I got my Christmas bonus that year in 2017. And I was told, because I worked in markets and capital markets at Citi, I have to jump through like a lot of compliance approvals to do any asset class investing. So I can't invest in like stocks, fixed income, currencies, commodities. Like, I can't invest in any of these things. The only things I could invest in was keep it in my bank account or buy real estate with it, right? It was too small an amount for real estate. And I don't want to keep it in my account. I was 20, 21 at the time. So I was just very clear that I don't want to do this. So I ended up speaking to my friends and family, and I was like, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You've been talking about all of this blockchain distributed ledger crap for like 3-4 months now. Might as well just put it there. So I actually ended up buying a huge chunk of Bitcoin and Ethereum at the time. And as you can imagine, this was back in 2017. So it's done fairly well.
Yeah. That's such a cool story. Ash, you know what? I would like to play a game with you. It's going to be kind of a rapid fire wild cards kind of thing.
Nice.
So I'm going to ask you a question. You're going to, it doesn't have to be super fast answer. It doesn't have to be short, but I just wanted to build up a momentum by saying that. So I know, I know one thing about you. I don't know if it's a saying or it's something that you go by, or it's kind of a mantra of yours, maybe not a mantra, but I know about strong opinions weakly held. And I love it. And so what's one belief about, I don't know, investing or tech or life you're totally wrong about?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Yeah, I think I grew up in a very, very meritocratic environment where, you know, my entire, like any child, honestly, who's growing up middle, lower class in India would have this benchmark that your entire worth is dependent upon what your score is in school. So if you're scoring above 90, you're a good kid. If you're scoring below 90, you're a bad kid. If you're scoring below 70, you basically are completely incompetent and a complete loser. These are like the benchmarks in India. There are lots of pros and cons. I grew up hating this culture. Obviously, as you can imagine, any child would hate it. Looking back, I feel this breeds adversity that makes you extremely, you know, high grit. And it helps you breed and look at innovation very differently. So I think my perspective on scores has changed. I used to think that universities, like the university that you end up going to, is the key benchmark for success, right? Like, if you don't go to an IIT or one of the top tier sort of, you know, non-tech schools, you are not worth in India. And after, like, you know, the last 10 years of being in tech, I've met a bunch of founders who are from the top universities and cleared all the exams and have the highest IQs, and they're not able to build big companies, right? And then you meet like someone who's not had a good academic background at all. And they basically had very diverse experiences, other areas of life where they showed their excellence and their brilliance, which went unnoticed because they were not in the right cultural environment. And they end up building massive businesses. So my perspective now is that if you've not struggled in some way, shape or form growing up, irrespective of whether you were an academic brilliant topper or not, doesn't matter. If you've not struggled, you can't build a big business. So I think for me, adversity has become the key North Star as opposed to academic brilliance.
Tika.
Love it.
Ash, what's your most unpopular opinion currently?
That's a good one. Most unpopular opinion. I mean, I keep posting so many on my Twitter at this point. I'm like trying to run through that directory in my head. Probably that hardware investing is not a good idea. I think the majority of the investors I speak to, at least, they are very, very bearish on hardware in general. I invest a lot in deep tech. And my perspective is that you time a hardware investment correctly and you can make billions. So if we look at, you know, Sequoia's investment in NVIDIA, it's fantastic, but it also was, you know, a 20, 30 year investment, maybe more than that, actually. That's it's an amazing investment, but again, it's a very long-term investment. If we just look at the everyday person, if you and I, we bought NVIDIA in 2014, it was 44 cents, $1,000 invested at that time would be over 2 million today, right? You could basically buy a house and say that, oh, I bought a $1,000 house. Right. So timing a hardware bet correctly, in my opinion, can give the kind of returns and, you know, venture scale outcomes in a short period of time if you just know and you kind of go after the right market segments. So, yeah, hardware investing, I think I'm fairly bullish on. And I also helped build this community called Bond. It's a community of like deep tech founders, investors, researchers, operators globally at this point. And it's just basically a WhatsApp community. And we do a lot of events in New York, SF and London, where all these people come together and we talk about what exactly they are building. And I would say about 80% of the founders, if not more, in that community are hardware founders. So I'm fairly personally bullish on the right kind of hardware. But yeah, very few investors I see that in. So.
Amazing. I love it. I want in, actually. I want to be in this community.
We get you in.
If you could steal one skill from any founder or investor, what would it be?
Do I have to name the investor or just the skill?
No, you don't have to. Just tell me the skill. What would you steal from them?
I think the big vision picture. I think what happens sometimes when you're an investor, you end up going so deep and you speak to so many customers and enterprises and, you know, consumers, etc., where you try to figure out whether this product, this business has merits. And you kind of get to sort of a point where you're trying to validate your theory, your thesis, right? Sometimes because of that, you lose the sight of the forest because of these trees. Sometimes it's like the big vision where I'm take NVIDIA, for example, again, right? So if I was someone who was betting on AI ML as a theme, one of the things I would have had broadly would have been compute, right? And not just, you know, the competency of the research that's going behind LLMs. Or any of the others. LLMs is like one of the many things that have broken out of ML, but like there are so many other sort of sectors of ML as well and sections which have done fairly well as well. But if as an investor I had that big vision where AI as a theme would be sort of where it is, I would then have very good clarity of thought that yes, foundation models would require compute and compute would require hardware and so on and so forth. So I think sometimes it's the big vision, which I've seen like a few investors have very intuitively I've seen them hear a founder pitch and immediately they can zoom out and throw the big vision picture to the founder and ask a question about it. And I'm just blown away by that. So yeah, I think that is a superpower in my opinion. I don't know whether that is talent, whether that comes with practice. I'm yet to learn that for sure.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I like it. What's the most non-obvious skill that makes someone a great investor?
It's a skill where I feel I ended up sort of, you know, being on the above average side of things. But I feel most people, even most investors, don't realize that that, in my opinion, is a prerequisite to becoming a great investor. Like if there's one common strength that all the best investors on this planet have, I think this is the answer to that. And it is the ability to read people better than they can, they know themselves. It's a superpower. It is something I've seen some of the most successful investors 2 minutes in meeting a founder. Like my managing partner Saul once met a founder briefly at an event, right? And I mean, Marshan, you've attended events. You know what I'm talking about. When you're on a panel or you've just like gone there for a minute, you speak to, there's so many people who'll come to you afterwards and you'll just say hi to everyone and speak to them for maximum 2 minutes, right? Because there are so many, you can't speak to everyone in depth. He literally met one of those founders, texted me and goes, met this guy. He is absolutely amazing. We should definitely stay in touch and look at what he's building. And he ended up building something incredible. Like it's just, the story is literally a 1 year old story and he's building something absolutely fantastic. He's in stealth right now. Otherwise I would share everything. So yeah, I've seen some investors being able to read people very quickly. And I think it kind of goes back to the story as to why I wanted to become a venture investor in the first place. I don't know if this is too long an answer. Can I share this?
No, it's not.
So there's
this, I want to hear, but anyway, even if it is, I want to hear how did you, you know, what is the story behind you becoming the venture investor?
It's actually a study that I read quite a while ago. Now, I think I was 15 or 16, if I remember correctly. It was in Tim Urban's newsletter or some newsletter, I can't remember now. But it's 10, 12 years ago, I read this, where it's about chicken sexers. So in Japan, in the 1920s, there was this notion where all the students who are like under the age of 6 or 8 would be taken to a barn next to the school and be asked to kind of segregate baby chicks who look completely identical into male and female. Like by looking at the face, you cannot distinguish between a male chicken and a female chicken. They would have to pick the chicken up, look at the genitalia, and segregate that into male and female. Children, like students at the school who were doing this for 3 months, literally 3 months, went from 0% accuracy, like very, very low, negligible accuracy, to 99% accuracy, where they don't even have to pick up the baby chick anymore. And just by looking at the face,
that's amazing.
They can segregate with 99% accuracy into male and female. There is literally a scientific basis for gut feeling. So this gut is something that comes from, I don't know whether it's pattern recognition, it's practice. What exactly is it? Some people pick it up very quickly. So that is where I say it's a natural born talent that they have identified. Some people spend 20 years building it, which to me is like the debate between nurture and nature, right? Like whether, you know, it's your environment that has taught you, whether it's like a talent you're born with, doesn't matter. But best investors have this. It's that gut feeling where they can read founders very quickly.
You know what I think it is? I think the more people, the more different environments, the more cultures, the more countries, the more situations, challenges you're exposed to over, I don't know, a shorter period of time, the better you get at actually reading people or having this pattern recognition. Just the more people you meet and the more different experiences with them you have, the more different characters you meet, you're just getting this. So some people are having this kind of, I don't know, opportunity or choose to do that. And therefore, they kind of get it from, like, have it from the get-go. Like, it feels like they were born with it. But they were just exposed to those different people because they travel a lot, change schools, change countries, change cultures. And they were just exposed to different things. And so it feels like they were born with it, but they were not. And some just, for some, it takes over 20 years because they are doing it now. Yeah. They're kind of, you know, experiencing it and having
Exactly.
And I think that this is like just the more you're exposed to, the better you become at this.
Exactly.
And I think that's kind of how it works. And I think to me, the most important thing while doing that is just to kind of remain kind and do good. 100%. And so I wanted to tell you, we're going to cut all this actually, because this was too long. So like, we're going to cut from the moment you ask if it's too long of an answer till now, we're going to cut it all.
No, that's fine.
No, I'm joking. We're not going to. I wanted to ask you, what's one piece of wisdom that everyone believes, but you think it's total bullshit?
Oh, well. I can say so many things right now that can get me in trouble. This is a good one.
Yeah, this is what this podcast is about. Like, we are actually, I'm trying to get you in trouble with every question.
That's the sole purpose you started a podcast.
Yes.
I think one of the biggest things which a lot of people don't believe in, don't understand, and completely disagree with is that, in my opinion, most businesses don't need funding.
Hmm.
They actually don't. A lot of founders, in my opinion, are gaslit by VCs into taking funding. And they end up building $500 million businesses, which is fantastic if you think about it, right? Like zero to 500 million. That's a huge, huge business. Which if the founders had not diluted too much of the company or not done too many raises and had just done maybe like a friends and family round for a million or 2 million, they could have built, let's say, a $200 million business. From a founder lens, that's generational wealth, right? Even if they diluted like, I don't know, 10, 20% of the business, they would have still netted minimum 50 million each. And I see these $500 million exits where the founders make 10 million, 5 million, barely anything, right? For a massive business. So to me, it's better to kind of have a very good understanding of the problem that you're solving and the market that you're solving it in and whether or not it is a venture scale market. If it is not, raise friends and family round. Sometimes take debt. That is better than raising venture capital because VCs are all about marking up their current investments.
Yeah,
that is their North Star. They will continuously push you to raise more capital, which is not needed by your business. And then you'll have too much capital and you would have a very high valuation and not enough revenue and then you're stuck. And these are called zombie companies. And these zombie companies, because they are like the undead, right? Like they can't be alive or be dead. So they are somewhere in the middle. These are companies that cannot IPO, that sometimes achieve too high a valuation, sometimes multi-billion dollar valuations, where they can't be acquired. And even the amount of equity that the founders combined own is sub 10%. So even in a fantastic outcome, they would make like very little in comparison to the amount of value they have actually created. Yeah. So yeah, I think my experience in venture capital has told me a lot of businesses actually don't need venture funding. And when I meet a founder, I'm very, very honest and direct with them that you are doing a horrible, horrible mistake, in my opinion. By raising venture funding, you should just do a small round and build it as a lifestyle business. Even if it becomes like a $50 million business, dude, you get to keep the $50 million, right? If you don't raise any funding.
Yeah. Ash, you know, I recently started asking people, like every guest that I get on the podcast, about the best advice they ever received in their life, because I'm kind of building this library of best advices and I want to build this library in order to be able to go there and have it available for myself whenever I need it.
Amazing.
Because I don't want to ask someone for advice when I actually need it, because then, like, for two reasons, can be not a good moment because I'm already needing it. So, you know, like if you in need for advice, maybe it's not the best time to ask it. And then on the other side, maybe not a good moment for the person or people you ask to give you the advice. So I would rather proactively build this, you know, library of great advice and then access it whenever I want. So my question is, what's the, maybe let's make two questions out of this. What's the worst piece of advice you ever received in your life, and was the best one?
Wow. Worst was, oh my God, I have so many bad. I think I'm going to start with the bad because I've received some horrible, horrible advice in life. The worst that always comes to my mind, and I'm very open about it, and I've told those people as well that advice that you gave me 5 years ago was absolute trash. Like, please do not give it to anyone else. The worst was keep your head down and do as you're told.
Whoa. Okay. That sounds bad already.
Exactly, right?
Why would you ever take it? Like, just...
Yeah, I got this advice when I was in college, in undergrad, and it's Asian culture. It is it is exactly that. Just keep your head down, listen to the teachers, listen to the parents, keep you know, sort of scoring that incremental value in ACADS, ignore everything else, do not let yourself build a personality, do not date, don't be wholesome, right? Like, just keep your head down and follow exactly what you're told. It's the quintessential conformist, submissive environment. It has its pros, but I think this advice being given today to the young generation does more harm than good, right? So I think it's horrible advice. Please never, nobody should ever follow it. And I think the best advice that somebody has given me is, not that they have given me, they've just given the world, is Warren Buffett's, be fearful when greedy and greedy when fearful.
All right.
Right? Like, when the markets, that's his entire contrarian investing style. When everyone else is like, oh my God, this is absolutely a trash industry, a trash company, it's really bad, be greedy. Go and buy as much of that company as you can because it's low priced. In the best case situation, in case the winds turn, that low-priced company will generate higher returns than a highly loved, valued company, even in the best environment. In like, they'll give like 10, 20, 40% returns. So fearful when greedy and greedy when fearful is a great, great advice. Like, do not ever invest in companies where everyone is putting all their money.
Nice. I like it. I liked it a lot, Ash. This is going to be the last one. And after this question, you're going to be fully known to the world. I can tell you that. Maybe it's going to be the toughest one. Maybe not. Let's check. Let's go with it. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words.
I immediately can think of 3.
Okay.
Curious, creative, grounded. I'm always very curious. I am always very creative. I'm ADHD, so I think that creativity just follows through. And I strive to be very, very grounded and as approachable as possible. Helpful. So approachable, helpful. Be helpful, pay it forward. Don't think anyone is ever beneath you. They are just behind in the journey, but they will catch up or even overtake you one day. So be helpful, pay it forward, and always keep evolving your thinking. I think as a human being, we need to have a growth mindset, and everyone needs to be aware that, you know, Charles Darwin's theory, survival of the fittest, is still very true. So we all got to be evolving to be the to be the best versions of ourselves.
Perfect. I love it. These were like 500 words.
So basically it's curious, creative, grounded, helpful, evolving. 5.
Amazing. Nice. Everyone, give it up for Ash. Ash, thank you so much. I've been enjoying so much this conversation. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Barcelona soon. I think people love it. I hope you loved it. Thank you for taking the time and joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. The questions were fantastic. Really lovely meeting you. And can't wait for Barcelona.
Awesome. We're going to have some fun.
Yeah.